Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Kevin McCullough here. Great to be with you. This week, Texas passes pro-life legislation that is already saving human lives.
This is a huge step in ending abortion in the state of Texas.
Albert Moeller gives analysis.
We are right now at one of the major decision points, perhaps even one of the major turning points in this country, on the issue of the sanctity of human life.
We'll look at the botched departure from Afghanistan.
Simple math shows that there's like 4,500 Americans that are still stranded behind enemy lines.
And what we left behind.
Helicopters, Blackhawks, C-130s, M4s, night vision goggles, military equipment, uniforms.
We've got all this and more. I'm Kevin McCullough, your host, coming to you from my home station in New York City, where you can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on AM 570 and FM 102.3 The Mission, WMCA. Take a moment to follow The Christian Outlook on Twitter. That's TC Outlook. And you can follow me on Instagram at KMC Radio. Great to be with you. We'll start with Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott has signed the Heartbeat Bill, legislation that prohibits abortion any time past the six-week mark of pregnancy. It's an enormous step forward for the cause of life. I turned to a bold leader in the pro-life movement, Abby Johnson. The former director of a Planned Parenthood clinic was a guest on my program on Kevin McCullough Radio on AM 570 The Mission in New York City. How big is this law that went into effect in Texas overnight?
Yeah, it's huge. Texas is one of the top five abortion states. It's five states in the nation that make up more than half of the abortions in our country. Texas is one of those five. So the fact that 100 to 150 babies are going to be spared from abortion every single day because of the Heartbeat law, it's huge. And, you know, there have been many other states that have passed heartbeat bills. They've been struck down by courts. This is the first type of law of its kind. It brings civil action. So it's written differently. We did that on purpose. And it's gone through the courts. It's gone through the circuit courts, gone through, you know, lower courts. And every court has said, no, this can go through. This can be enacted. Of course, pro-abortion groups then ask the Supreme Court, you know, in the 11th hour, can you please enjoin this? Can you please make it so that this does not go into effect? The Supreme Court has been silent so far. We take that as a good sign. They did not intervene. And so today, babies are going to be protected. So if a heartbeat is detected on an ultrasound, that baby cannot be killed by abortion.
So the pro-life community, and you know it well, but as long as I've been involved in it, it's always been identified by kind of two groups: the purists that want to end everything immediately and won't stop with incremental victories, and then there's the more pragmatic incrementalists that will say, let's make progress and save as many as we can as fast as we can, and, you know, get to that ultimate saving of all lives. But let's take what we can as it presents. This is a huge incremental win and something that people have been pushing for. If you're going to have arguments about when life begins, certainly when something's heartbeat is registering sound, that would seem to indicate that whatever was producing that heartbeat is, in fact, living.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's generally how we measure death, right, in this country. When
certainly,
the heart stops.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if that's how we determine death, then that's when most people will say, okay, well, that's when we should determine that life starts, right?
Yeah.
And even people who I've talked to who are, you know, sort of on the fence about abortion or whatever, you know, I can even sort of get them with that argument. Well, when does life end? Well, when the heart stops. Okay, well, then when does life begin? And they'll say, okay, maybe when the heart starts, you know. And so, you know, now for those of us who are pro-life, we'll say, you know, well, of course it starts at the moment of conception. But,
sure.
You know, this is a huge win. I mean, you know, even for incrementalists, or for people who aren't incrementalists, even for people who want to just abolish abortion outright, which we all do. I mean, that's, that is the end goal.
Well, that's the secret. That's the secret goal of the incrementalist is it's they're just willing to take some more wins to get there as opposed to the all or nothing.
Right,
approach.
And this is a huge win. This is abolishing 85 to 90% of abortions. I mean, that's dang near close to 100%. So we're abolishing almost all abortions in the state of Texas. This is a humongous win. This isn't like a, you know, like a tiny baby step. This is a huge step in ending abortion in the state of Texas.
There's no question about it. Texas will now be ground zero in the fight over abortion. Corporations are already trying to bully and coerce the Lone Star State into submission. And watch for this. Some who say they are pro-life will argue Texas went too far. Here's Dr. Albert Mohler from his briefing podcast.
We are right now at one of the major decision points, perhaps even one of the major turning points in this country on the issue of the sanctity of human life. But as we shall see today, and we're looking at a number of issues that simply have to be confronted, some of them as fresh as just going into the weekend, we have to understand that conservative Americans and conservative Christians are going to have to face the reality that we are going to have to make hard decisions, stand by very clear convictions, and pay whatever social cost is necessary in order to stand up for the unborn, to defend the defenseless, and to actually hold to a consistent understanding of the sanctity of human life. We'll be talking about why that is so. But just in order to remind ourselves of where we stand, just over the last week, a Texas law that effectively bans most abortions went into effect. And the Supreme Court of the United States allowed that Texas law to go into effect. Before going further, let's just understand. The Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, legalizing abortion nationwide, did not all of a sudden in all 50 states declare that abortion is now legal where it had been illegal. No, there were some states where abortion was already legal. What Roe v. Wade did was to federalize the issue, with the Supreme Court usurping an authority that certainly it should never have presumed to have, and it ordered the legalization of abortion basically on demand in all 50 states. But the United States has been riven on this issue, divided on this issue, and it's not just citizen versus citizen, it really is state versus state. Just to consider two states, for the sake of time, consider New York State and the state of Texas. In New York State, in recent years, the state has gone so far as to legalize abortion right up until the moment of birth. They're not going to put it in those words, but that's exactly what it has done, passing a radical abortion rights law that basically denies any personhood whatsoever to the unborn child until the very moment of birth. And as we shall see, that logic won't even hold at birth or beyond. But in a state like Texas, and Texas isn't alone, there are other states that would certainly be classified with it, the state of Texas has been moving in a more pro-life direction and has been experimenting with what laws will be allowed to stand by the Supreme Court. Now, behind that is an entire argument over constitutionality, how to read the Constitution. The people who represent the state of Texas say, when you look at the Constitution, there is no reference to abortion, of course. Therefore, the Constitution does not grant any such right to abortion. In the state of New York, it is as if the first and most fundamental right is the right to abortion. And when it comes to the divide between not only, say, the states of New York and Texas, but between America's two major political parties, you are looking at a divide that is so deep, it is hard to imagine how the United States will be able to move forward without something that amounts to unconditional victory for one side and unconditional defeat for the other. That is just where we stand, and honesty demands that we concede the fact. When I put it that way, I mean that the pro-abortion forces are absolutely adamant that every single state in the union, all 50 states, must have basically the same pro-abortion, they would often express it as pro-choice policy and position. That's what is now required by the Roe v. Wade decision, except for the fact that over the course of the last, say, 20 years, but in particular over the last 10 years, some of the most pro-life states have been moving to adopt legislation that, for example, in a fetal heartbeat bill, makes very clear that even under Roe, there are limitations upon a woman's so-called right to an abortion. And this is the big point. The states have been standing in again and again for limitations on abortion in the name of the sanctity of human life and for the defense of that unborn life. And of course, something like a fetal heartbeat bill is just one way of underlining the fact that the fetus is there. The unborn child is there. A human person made in God's image is there and is worthy of our defense, indeed demands our defense. But the pro-abortion forces are in absolute breakdown over the Texas law going into effect, and the president of the United States, Joe Biden, who is now basically the pro-abortion rights champion in chief, on Thursday and Friday made statements in which he indicated what would be his administration's absolute opposition to the Texas law. On Thursday, he spoke through a White House spokesperson. On Friday, he spoke to the issue himself. The president described the Texas legislation as almost un-American, and he went on to call for what he described as a whole-of-government effort to try to oppose the Texas legislation. Over the Labor Day weekend, Attorney General Merrick Garland went on to say that the Justice Department would defend what he construed as a woman's right to abortion in the state of Texas, though he did not go on to explain exactly how the Justice Department would accomplish opposition on the ground in Texas to this legislatively adopted and governor-signed law. But the big point I want to make on the briefing today is that this is not just another abortion story. This is not just another abortion law in the state of Texas. As a matter of fact, this law in Texas and the public response to it and our current cultural moment indicate we really are at a decision point. We may be at a turning point, one way or the other. And you can follow that with the reality that the Supreme Court, in the term that will begin just this fall, is going to be hearing and considering a basic frontal assault upon the Roe v. Wade decision that comes in the form of a law adopted in the state of Mississippi, defending unborn human life and restricting abortion. All that's to come. But where do we stand right now? Well, where we stand right now is that we have to understand something else the President of the United States said in his comments on Friday. The President of the United States, having for decades said that he believes, based upon his Roman Catholic convictions, he describes himself and is routinely described as a devout Roman Catholic. The President has stated over and over again throughout his political career that he personally believes that life begins at conception, and yet on Friday, speaking to the nation, the President of the United States contradicted himself, speaking of his respect for those who believe that life begins at conception, but saying that he does not agree.
Coming up, the botched exit from Afghanistan.
Simple math shows that there's like 4,500 Americans that are still stranded behind enemy lines.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Fire Department, 408, where's the fire?
Yeah, hi, I'm on the 106th floor of the World Trade Center. We just had an explosion up here.
Okay, 106th floor. What building are you in, sir? One or two?
One World Trade.
All right.
There's smoke, and we got about 100 people up here.
Do not leave, okay? There's a fire or an explosion or something in the building. All right, I want you to stay where you are.
Right, oh, now. There's another one. Another plane just hit. Right. Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit. It hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Explosion.
Oh, my God. There it goes.
The whole building just came apart.
Oh,
holy smokes.
And there, as you can see, perhaps the second tower, the front tower, the top portion of which is collapsing. Good Lord. There are no words.
The central fact of the morning is that thousands of Americans have been killed by a terrorist attack. And the repercussions will reverberate for decades to come.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. This weekend, the nation marched 20 years since the attacks of 9/11. Those attacks were a horrific wake-up call to the horrors of Islamist terror.
We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
In the 20 years since that fateful day, we've had numerous additional reminders about the threat from various radical terror groups. And many Americans had also grown weary of the ongoing effort in Afghanistan. But virtually no one is defending what the Biden administration did in their botched withdrawal. Greg Stubbe served with the Army in the nation's efforts after 9/11. Today he serves the nation in Congress, representing Florida's 17th congressional district. He was a guest of my colleague, Bill Bunkley, on Faith Talk AM 570 in Tampa Bay.
Did you ever think in our lifetime, your lifetime, we would be facing the mess that we're facing today? And many people, even in the chamber that you serve, it's like they've lost their minds. Getting started here.
Yeah, I never exactly what you just said. I said yesterday, just in a private conversation with somebody, I never thought in the history of our nation that we would be facing not just one, but several of the issues that we're facing. You've got the pandemic and all the craziness that's coming with that, with vaccines and not vaccines and forcing people to wear masks and all of that. And then you have the crisis on the border, which isn't getting a lot of press time right now, despite the fact that still hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants are pouring across our southern border right now. And then you have Afghanistan. And never in my military service or in the history of our nation, of our values, not just as Americans, but our values as it relates to the military, would I ever have thought that I would have witnessed a scenario where we have left Americans behind enemy lines knowingly, and in some cases intentionally tried to avoid getting them clearance to leave. There's reports of different individuals in different parts of the country who the State Department is refusing to give them authorization to fly on other aircraft to enter other airspace in other countries because it wasn't a State Department organized mission. I mean, it's just absolutely beyond the pale. When this first started, it was we were being told, this is Congress. Congress was being told there was between 10 and 15,000 Americans that were still in Afghanistan. This was like a week and a half before Biden gave the order to pull out. As of today, we are told that there's 5,500 Americans that they pulled out of Afghanistan. Well, simple math, even if you take the less number of the two they gave us, shows that there's like 4,500 Americans that are still stranded behind enemy lines, and they want to tell us, oh, it's 100, it's 200, and then they want to lie to the American people and say, oh, these are people that had the opportunity to leave, but they don't want to leave. I don't know anybody in this country that would believe that, given what they're seeing on the news and the pictures that you're seeing and knowing the history of the Taliban, but they're continuing to lie to the American people to cover their complete dereliction of duty, complete abolition of our military ethos, that we don't leave people behind. And they just picked up and left. Some of the stories I'm reading is there were Americans with passports at the gate, waving their passport. They wouldn't let them in. I mean, just astronomical stories that as this time goes on, these people make it back, hopefully, or you're getting insight of what's happening over there. You're going to get some of these stories, and it's just going to continue as to how bad it really was. And that's not even getting into take the human toll out of it for a second. And then you look at the financial and the military toll. We left the amount of aircraft that we left. Helicopters, Blackhawks, C-130s, M-4s, night vision goggles, military equipment, binoculars, uniforms. I mean, that's going to be Joe Biden's legacy and this administration's legacy is the Taliban in our uniforms and in our equipment and our weapons erecting the Taliban flag, mocking our Marines.
There was a parade in Afghanistan by the Taliban, and they put on our costumes like it's Halloween or something, because they would never, ever shape up to men like you that served. So they put on our uniforms, they drove all of our equipment in the military parade, and we were told that all the aviation was dismantled, and I understand there was a Chinook that was being flown by the Taliban over the parade. When you see those images, I know your blood boils, but tell us a little bit on behalf of all the veterans that are listening this afternoon, because I am so ashamed for them, including both my parents who served in World War II in the Army Air Corps. Your thoughts about those images?
Well, every American, whether you served or not, should be absolutely appalled that we would just pick up and leave without destroying that equipment. We have the capability to go in there, whether it's fixed wing or whether it's a drone or whatever the case may be. You would think that as all of this was happening, they would be telling the Afghan soldiers to take incinerator grenades and just destroy everything as they're leaving their post, surrendering to the Taliban. But even if that didn't happen, we have the capabilities to fly in there and destroy our stuff. I filed a bill with a Democrat when all of this was happening, declaring that Congress was demanding the Biden administration rescue every American citizen that is there and then go in and either recover our equipment or destroy it. And now, because everything militarily is pulled out, we don't have any assets in country, we don't have an aircraft carrier nearby, they're having to fly missions out of the UAE and Bahrain and all these other places that are like 7 to 8 hour flights. So they're going to burn most of their fuel getting there to get back, because now we don't have any strategic place in order to launch missions from. So it's going to make it terribly difficult unless Biden wants to put a bunch of things on an aircraft carrier and send them out there to destroy all this stuff, which, you know, he doesn't want to do that. We have surrendered technology, things that we had advantages on the battlefield, like night vision goggles and all these different assets that we had. It's now in the hands of our enemy. And take it a step further, you know, they're giving them to the Chinese. They're giving them to the Russians. They're giving them to the Iranians, because the Iranians are right next door. And so now the Iranians have Black Hawks and Black Hawk technology and night vision technology and all these other things. It's just, there's not words strong enough in the English language to describe my frustration and anger. And what's really frustrating is being in Congress, watching all this happen, and we're in the minority in the House, we're in the minority in the Senate, we have a Democratic administration that's doing all this, and there's nothing we can do about it. We can file impeachment proceedings, they're not going to be heard. We can talk all day long. Nothing's going to happen, because there's not a single Democrat in the House that's willing to stand up and say, this is wrong, we don't leave Americans behind, this needs to be rectified, we need to go in and do it. And you're hearing crickets from all of them. They're not going to impeach Biden. They're not going to go in and force the administration to go do things. It's going to just be that they're going to hope this just goes away and move on to the next crisis that they've created for our country until the midterm elections, where they all realize that they're going to lose.
Coming up.
If you don't have an understanding of the role religion and a relationship with God plays in your own life, then how could you understand how impactful it is in someone else?
More on Afghanistan when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Kevin McCullough. In the immediate aftermath of the attacks of 9/11 here in New York, the intelligence service of the U.S. went on something of a scramble, looking for people who spoke Arabic or who had deep familiarity with Islam and the Muslim world. Hadia Muhammadi was a part of that effort, helping our intelligence agencies understand this new threat. Initially, she was a Muslim. Today, she's a committed follower of Christ. Hadia was a guest of Don Crow on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
You say early in this column, the terrible miscalculation of the capabilities and willingness of the Afghan army and the national police to defend their nation is primarily the result of systemic corruption. Elaborate on that point, because you've already touched on it a bit, I think, with what you just said.
Sure. It is, again, the reason I complain that it's a spiritual problem is that our military-industrial complex, our private contractors, our government officials kept rubber-stamping $1 million to the point where we reached billions of dollars of investment in an army and a police that they knew were not hitting the benchmark they needed to be effective. And we just kept spending the money because people were lining their pockets, even though we knew it wasn't going to be successful. Now, did we know it was going to be this unsuccessful this fast? I don't think anybody necessarily knew that, but we knew we weren't capable of holding the country in a way in which would be demanded considering all the money we spent. And that's just a result of corruption, not caring about the fact that you're asking for money and getting paid for something that you're not actually delivering.
You also early on talk about a former Army Ranger West Point grad who wrote in a blog as if he was a member of the Taliban writing to Americans, mocking the American generals, the American military establishment. Talk about that point.
So that Army Ranger started this company of sandals. And to me, not only does he blog about how critical he is now of the military and the invasion of Afghanistan, but we often made this reference to the fact that the Taliban fights battles and defeats us on the battlefield in flip-flops, in sandals, despite our, you know, extremely expensive and armor of our military. And I think that that's just part of the comments that he's making, is that they think our soldiers, our officials, our executives are undisciplined or are weak. And it just breaks my heart to think that people would consider Christians that way, and that's the way we come off oftentimes to the Muslim world. Because I heard it myself throughout my life going in Islam, that Christians are undisciplined, Christians are weak, they have no faith in God, and Islam will eventually defeat them.
You also write, not only have American diplomats and personnel engaged in egregious examples of financial deceit, we've already mentioned that briefly, some of the corruption in that regard, but you also said the majority of them do not value or understand the impact of religion, not their own and not that of their adversaries. And that's critical, isn't it?
Absolutely, because if you don't have an understanding of the role religion and a relationship with God plays in your own life, then how could you understand how impactful it is in someone else? And so that's why there's many of us supposed experts in this field look at the TV and listen to the split hairs over who ISIS-K is versus Al-Qaeda versus Taliban. And it's a distinction without a difference, because at the end of the day, they espouse a doctrine that leads them to want to kill and subdue anybody that doesn't follow their interpretation of the religion. No matter what alphabet soup their name is going by, they're united by doctrine. And if you can't understand how doctrine or relationship or your life relates to eternity, then you don't understand how it affects somebody else either. And that's why our policy keeps failing.
Well, you wrote it this way. The statement from President Biden that the Taliban is undergoing an, quote, existential crisis about whether they want legitimacy on the global stage, close quote, completely disregards the Taliban's unwavering commitment to one thing, an Islamic State. They are totally committed to their religion.
Yes, exactly.
Now, talk, if you would, about where to from here, and who knows where to from here.
Where do we go from here politically? What is going to happen to the reputation, the standing of the U.S. and of the West in general to these international forces, whether it's Islamic states or it's Russia and China? I think it's the decrease in America in the world is alarming. That's the problem, is that our allies are worried about whether it's dangerous to be allied to us, because they won't get the protection that they expect, and it makes them the enemy of their greatest adversary or their greatest threat, like Russia and China. And so it's very precarious for them to choose to align themselves to us right now.
Coming up, raising up kids in a culture that is hostile.
Be involved with what's going on in the school, be aware, and then be very intentional about teaching kids a Christian worldview too.
Sean McDowell, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. Those of us who are parents know the challenges in raising kids today. They're enormous. We're facing a hostile culture, a public education system that works to undermine so much of what we're trying to instill in our kids, and so many forms of social media that make it hard for any parent to keep up. Sean McDowell was a guest on KKLA in Los Angeles talking about his book titled Chasing Love, Sex, Love, and Relationships in a Confused Culture. Sitting in the host chair over at KKLA was Bob Lapine, a voice many of you will recognize from the program Family Life Today.
When your child comes home from school and says, what's a lesbian? We've got to be ready to have a winsome conversation. I tell parents all the time, you've got to practice your don't freak out face when your kids ask these questions. And you got to be able to say, sit down, let's talk. And then and the other thing not to do is say, okay, now I have to dump everything I know about this. We got to take the next 45 minutes
right,
and give a whole lecture, right? No, we just have a conversation and model for our kids. You can ask me about any of this stuff anytime, and I'm not afraid of it.
You know, I love that you said we got to be ready ahead of time. This is another thing my parents did well. My dad practiced in his own mind. What would I say if my daughter came and said, I'm pregnant? What would I say if my son said, hey, Dad, I'm gay? Like, he practiced this so he didn't freak out and could respond in a calm manner. I think that was a really smart practice to think of that ahead of time. The other thing that parents can do is if your daughter, the question you said earlier, Bob, if your daughter's son goes, hey, Mom, Dad, what's a lesbian? You can ask a question back and say something like, you know what, that's a really good, important question. I'm happy to tell you what I think, but can you tell me, why do you ask? Where'd you hear that term? Or what makes you curious about this topic? And then, number one, it creates a conversation. Number two, gives you a little bit of time to just think, take a deep breath, and give a more thoughtful answer as well.
We talk about parents freaking out. I know you hit your dad with the kind of a statement that would cause a parent to freak out. Was it when you were in high school that you said you weren't sure if you believed in Jesus?
I was, I think, 19 years old. I believe it was around my sophomore year at Biola, so 1920. And just, I'm not sure I ever rejected my faith. I just hit that point that a lot of people hit where you go, whoa, do I really believe this? Can I answer these tough questions? Am I just believing this because my parents believe it? Like, that just kind of hit me in a fresh way because it was mid-90s and I was surfing the internet and met some smart people who gave good reasons to doubt the Christian faith. And I expressed that to my dad. And we had a conversation about it. He didn't freak out. He told me that he loved me. He told me that, hey, what I need to do is follow truth no matter where it leads. And I thought that was great advice. It really freed me up to know that my relationship with him wasn't contingent upon whether I believed in Jesus or not. And, you know, he said something interesting to me. He said, you know, only reject what you've learned growing up if you're convinced it's not true. And that's what my dad's tried to model to me, is just follow and live truth, even if it's costly. And that's what he modeled and I try to do with my kids. So you're right. In Chasing Love, that's one thing that I try to do is when my dad read it, he goes, son, this isn't just for students. This is like going to help adults how to communicate these ideas in a language and on a level that 14, 16, 18-year-olds can really get in terms of the questions that they're asking. There are intentional strategies, and I think it's fair to call it indoctrination, to get our kids to buy certain views of sexuality tied to, say, how the LGBTQ community would view things. And what's interesting is you can opt your kids out of certain training on, like, condoms or AIDS, but you cannot opt your kids out of what's called gender education, because that would be discriminatory. And it starts kindergarten all the way through high school, including, if I remember correctly, there were kind of ways that they train kids that if their parents weren't on board with these ideas, here's how they could talk with their parents.
If you had kids in a public school classroom, what kind of an offensive approach would you take to make sure that they're protected from some of what they're going to hear in the classroom?
I went to a public school in California all the way growing up. And one thing my parents did is they were very involved. They took the time to get to know the teachers, and not with some hidden agenda. They wanted to know the teachers. They gave the teachers a benefit of the doubt. They wanted to partner with the teachers. Second, they took a lot of time to build a relationship with me and to have conversations about what I was learning in school. And then they were also very intentional about teaching me a Christian worldview. So I'm not telling parents they shouldn't send their kids to public schools. I don't think that's my place. I think sometimes homeschool, sometimes private, sometimes public can be the best, depending on the particular kid and resources you have. But we have to be very intentional. So those who send their kids to public schools, start these conversations early, be involved with what's going on in the school, be aware, and then be very intentional about teaching kids a Christian worldview too.
And you got to be careful. I mean, when your child walks in the back door at 4:15, and you don't just run up and say, "So what'd you learn today?" You know, you can't be fearful and breathless and act like you're freaking out, or your child's just going to shut down and have no communication with you.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a time and a place to build good relationships with kids. And a lot of that is just asking the right questions. Tell them stories of people that stood up for their faith and stood boldly and did the right things, and model that for our kids. It's those stories that give them the courage. One is a biblical story, like Daniel chapter 1. Daniel stands up and refuses to compromise. That's a story I use a ton with this generation. But yes, we got to realize that if kids take Scripture seriously, it flies in the face of much of what's being taught in culture, and kids can be labeled bigoted, hateful, intolerant, homophobic, and many more adjectives to go along with that.
Have you and Stephanie ever had the conversation, look, let's just get 20 acres in Montana, and let's just, we'll build a fence, and we'll go out there, no internet, and just raise the kids to, you know, love the outdoors and love Jesus?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. We got to go to a ranch in Wyoming this year, and my wife, you know, there's a certain romantic feeling that goes with it that makes things feel simpler.
Yep.
But you know what? I love California. There's certain things I hate about it. But, you know, Scripture says God puts us in a time and place for a reason. And Hebrews 13:21 says God will equip us with all good things to do his will for our life. So, yes, I have those romantic moments, but then I come back to just the call that Scripture has and the privilege it is to raise our kids, to parent our kids. And we need to lean into that rather than leaning away from it.
Coming up.
You know, not only can you not add a day to your life, but you might end up taking days off of your life, you know, as you worry. So worry is useless.
In the final segment of The Christian Outlook, stay with us.
Before I spoke a word, you were singing over me.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. We live in stressful times, from the pandemic to our political polarization to the chaos we see on the world stage. There is plenty to worry about. But we do well to remember Christ's words. Which of you, by worrying, can add a single day to his life's span? Bill Glaze is the pastor of Bethany Baptist Church in Pittsburgh. He was a guest of John and Kathy on WORD-FM.
So, Bill, in that congregation, anybody anxious?
Yeah, I would say there's a lot of anxiety that's going on, not only in our congregation, but, you know, throughout the body of Christ. And, you know, we definitely know there's a lot of anxiety, you know, in the world. I was interested to read about the Capistranos and the Swallows in San Juan Capistrano.
Yeah.
How that every year they leave at a certain time. And almost to the day, every year they come back. Well, you know, how do they do that? How do they know how to do that? You know, God instinctively has put in certain creatures, you know, these things. You know, when Kathy came to visit us that day, I was doing a series on animals.
Yeah, right, birds.
You know, and I was talking about how God instinctively puts things in animals, you know, actually for lessons for us and for examples. And so to think that you'll hear God puts in these swallows every year to leave on a certain date and every year to come back on a certain date. And if God can do that, and these are, you know, birds, these are creatures that are not created in his image, how much more can he do it for us, knowing that he is our Father? So if God is taking care of the birds and he's taking care of the grass, surely he can take care of us. And then the last thing I want to say is what I call the principle of uselessness. And basically, worrying will not change anything. He says that, can you add one cubit to your stature? Now, this has been interpreted two ways. One way is a cubit was 18 inches. And so, you know, if I'm 5'11 and I want to play in the NBA, you know, and I wanted to get to be, you know, 7 foot. You know, me worrying about it, grunting, you know, groaning and trying to stretch, it's not going to add one cubit to my stature. You know, so Jesus said that worry is not going to do that. But then he gives there's another analogy that comes from that, too, when it says not add one cubit to your stature. It means that, you know, you can't add a day to your life by worrying about it. As a matter of fact, you know, not only can you not add a day to your life, but you might end up taking days off of your life, you know, as you worry. So worry is useless. There's an old Jewish saying that says this: do not worry over tomorrow's evils, for you know not what today will bring forth. Perhaps tomorrow you will not be alive, and you will have worried for a world which will not be yours.
That wraps up this edition of The Christian Outlook. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about our program. Send them to ChristianOutlook.com to subscribe to our podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posehn, Mike Cook, Alex Perez, and Nicholas Malone, I'm Kevin McCullough. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook.